When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today because we get to talk about a book that I think does a bunch of interesting things. It takes us back to a particular time and place. What did people think of friendship at this particular moment? Why does that matter, right? There are some implications here on our understanding of literature, both kind of in that time and going forward. And so this book, I think, this conversation, I hope, will take us to a different place, take us a little bit out of our everyday in interesting ways, because I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Coggeshall about her book titled On Amista, Negotiating Friendship in Dante's Italy, published by the University of Toronto Press. Beth, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda. I'm delighted to be here.
We are delighted to have you. Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I'm a native English speaking Italian scholar, which I always think is an important thing to point out because, as an Italian instructor, I like to point out to my students that it is very possible to study Italian in college and nevertheless become an Italianist. I am a professor of Italian studies at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida. I got a PhD in Italian from Stanford University in 2012. And that's obviously where this book project was born. It was born as a dissertation project. And I got interested in the project in the first place because when I was a graduate student and I already knew that I was interested in Dante. I already knew that I wanted to study, to write a dissertation about Dante or about his period. But it's next to impossible to find a good topic in Dante studies that hasn't already been covered by 700 years of scholarship. And I, at the time, was kind of casting around trying to figure out what to write about. And I would sit with my best friend, who was also in the PhD program, who was working on 20th and 21st century French literature. We would sit at a coffee shop and she'd work on her dissertation and I would sort of read around for my dissertation. And then we would take breaks and we would go and sit outside and talk about what we had studied, what we'd been reading, or talk about ideas that we were having or questions that were coming up or problems that we were having. And I started to think about whether Dante would have done this with his own friends, whether this is the kind of conversation that Dante would have had with his friends. I'm writing a poem or I had a dream about, I'm thinking about this question. And to engage in those kinds of conversations in informal ways. So that's where I got interested in the topic. That's where I got interested in the project, sort of thinking about my own friendships and how those were impacting my work and wondering about whether we could track the same kind of relationship in the late 13th and early 14th centuries in this canonical poet's set of works.
Hmm. No, that's always so interesting to hear about how people kind of come to projects. So thank you for giving us that background. Before we get into kind of answering, I suppose, the question you've raised, can you tell us a bit more about kind of the stakes of the question? How does understanding this, going into this aspect of Dante's world, help us understand kind of literature and developments in literature more broadly?
Yeah. And it's also a question, I wrote the dissertation that became this book in 2012. And so at the time I was really interested in you know, Facebook was very popular, for example, at the time. And so people were sort of differentiating between what it means to have to be a friend and to be a Facebook friend, that those were somehow two different categories in people's minds. And so I got curious about the sort of ways that we use the language of friendship in I don't know, slippery ways, I guess, ambiguous, ambivalent ways. And so I think, you know, part of the broader relevance of a project like this is to track the ways that we talk and don't talk about relationships that are really foundational to our everyday social lives, especially our friendships. I don't think we have very good ways of talking about, theoretically talking about friendships. And so in part, I wanted to think about this because it's something that it's a question that I think about in my everyday life. I think those are the stakes for me. Specifically in regards to Dante and his historical period, I think what's really crucial about this is that, you know, we tend to bifurcate the Middle Ages and the Renaissance as being, you know, two, I don't want to say sharply contrasting periods or anything like that, but we see really like a fundamental break between them. And there's been a lot of scholarship done to take apart that idea of that fundamental break between the two time periods. And so in part, this book participates in that wider scholarly endeavor where I'm looking at how the constructions of friendship in the late medieval period set the groundwork for what we would see as a large social shift in the early modern period, in the very early modern period. And so there was a lot of ambiguous language of friendship that was being tossed around already by Dante and his contemporaries that would allow Renaissance conceptions of friendship to really, shift to look very different from mm-hmm. the theoretical conceptions of friendship that had endured in, especially in a Christian mindset for mm-hmm. centuries.
So that obviously goes some of the way, and especially given that emphasis on timing, to explaining kind of why Dante. But I suppose that's kind of worth discussing a bit anyway. Could you tell us more about kind of why he's the center of this investigation?
Yeah, I mean, in part, it's just my own preference for the text. I just love the poem so deeply. I started studying the poem, and I met Dante when I was an undergraduate in college, and was just completely floored by the ways that the Commedia opens up a universe of existence that I had never imagined or had little access to, 700 years after the death of the poet. I love the poem. I think the poem invites reflection on all kinds of aspects of our daily existence that I've just never found another poem that's able to do that. And so in part, it's just my own fascination with Dante, with his poem, with his world that led me to focus on this. But obviously Dante is also, you know, I am not Dante's only fan. Dante is one of the crucial thinkers of you know, really all of Western history. And so taking a thematic thread that's, you know, a fundamental component of our social lives and investigating it in the works of one of the most canonical figures of Western literature just seemed like I was surprised that it hadn't been done before.
That all makes a lot of sense. Can you tell us a bit then about kind of having framed sort of why this investigation on a number of levels, how you then kind of went about answering it? How have you organized this book and how did you decide to do it this way?
Yeah, I got really interested in, you know, one of the things that I started thinking about or started noticing as I was reading, I spent a lot of time reading friendship theory. So classical conceptions of friendship, Christian conceptions of friendship leading up to Dante's period and contemporary with him. And I started noticing sort of how impossible the theory of friendship would be to put into practice. And so, you know, one of the most central figures of Dante's that Dante would have thought of as an authority on friendship would be Cicero. And Cicero writes that true friendship, what he calls vera amicizia, could only have existed between two men of equal, ideally of equal social standing, of equal excellence, of equal virtue, who love one another perfectly reciprocally, who in their love of one another always strive to make the other better and to make himself better simultaneously. And by better, I mean, you know, more virtuous, more excellent. And obviously this is a nearly impossible situation. This is not what any of my friendships look like, certainly. And so I started thinking, well, what happens when we try to put that into practice? What happens in you know, a messy social environment, whatever messy social environment that is, what kinds of contradictions arise? And so I identified a set of dilemmas that I think arise when we try to take friendship theory and apply it to a particular social setting, a particular social realm. You know, what philosophical dilemmas come out of that? And so I identified four of them and traced them through four of Dante's principal works.
Hmm. Lovely. That gives us a nice overview then to go into those details more closely. Starting with kind of what you mentioned at the beginning of that answer, what were the theories of friendship, the conceptions of friendship that Dante and his contemporaries sort of had to access?
Yeah, the primary one would have been Cicero. I mean, Cicero really dominated the thinking on friendship for centuries. And Cicero's thinking on friendship was actually fairly well incorporated into Christian communities by that point. And so, you know, the idea of vera amicizia, this true friendship, this morally upright, excellent friendship, is, you can see how it would be easily, or relatively easily accommodated into, say, Christian monastic traditions or Christian ethical writings of the time period. You know, we want to think about our friends as making us better people. There was also, I mean, within Christian societies, there was also a bit of ambiguity around friendship, simply because, you know, friendship in the monastic tradition, friendship could be seen as a danger. You know, if you think about the community of monks who are living together in the monastery and striving to love and support one another equally, we might wonder to ourselves what would happen if two of them have a special bond, a particular bond, a private bond that would allow for them to develop a certain kind of intimacy. And those intimacies could be, of course, they could lead to sexual intimacies. That's one of the grave dangers of friendship in a monastery. But they could also be, you know, simply shared confidences or a certain kind of allegiance between two that would draw those two away from the rest of their brethren. And so that was, I think there was a lot of writing about this, a lot of, I mean, Dante would have been privy to some of, certainly some of that thinking, if not some of that writing. And so that was in the air, I would say, these Christian conceptions, certainly Cicero. And then the kind of, I would say the momentous turn for Dante and his contemporaries would have been the rediscovery and translation of Aristotle's texts from, they came through Arabic, from Greek to Arabic, and then into Latin. That translation process allowed for Aristotle's texts to be rediscovered. They knew of Aristotle, but they hadn't they didn't have any access to many of Aristotle's texts, including his Ethics, where he dedicates two entire books to thinking about friendship. And so there's a really terrific history of friendship in the Middle Ages by Benedict Serre that describes the kind of shock that Aristotle's conceptions of friendship would have introduced into a Christian society that was pretty strictly revolved around a Ciceronian model of friendship. This kind of only friendship can only exist between two, and it must look like this. It must be virtuous, etc. Aristotle introduces all of these other, this range of forms of friendship where you can be friends with another person, you know, not because they make you a better person, but because you enjoy their company. Or you can be friends with a person because they provide certain advantages to you. That's still friendship in Aristotle's conception. You can be friends with people of different social status. You can be friends with your patron. You can be friends with your parent. You can be friends with your spouse. All of this is, I don't want to say excluded from the Ciceronian model, but Cicero didn't write about those forms of friendship. And so you can see how bringing in this wide conception of what friendship could be that Aristotle's works introduced for the period, how that broadening of that conception of friendship would create, let's say, like theoretical difficulties, right? It would force people into a position where they had to say, well, does this count as friendship? Is this a good kind of friendship? Is this a dissembling kind of friendship? They started to ask themselves, I think, lots of questions, either actively or passively, ask themselves lots of questions about what friendship is and can be.
So that does raise some kind of theoretical and conceptual questions for people. But you also talk about in the book kind of some practical challenges as well, integrating this into kind of real life. Can you tell us a bit more about what some of those challenges would have been?
So I think when we think about theories of friendship, we can't think about friendship as being, isolated from civic life or isolated from, broader social networks, right? We are not, my best friend and I are not friends in a vacuum. We are friends in a wide community of others. And Dante's community was a community that was enmeshed in a lot of turmoil. So much like our contemporary period, there was fierce partisan politics at play. People were deeply divided on their, in terms of their political allegiances. There were skirmishes in the public squares. There were, people trying to negotiate things like hierarchical divisions, right? The nobility versus the rising middle class. This theory of friendship is being applied in a particularly messy social circumstance. These, very crowded, large, booming, bustling cities like Florence, where social life was, it mattered quite a bit who your friends are. It mattered how you could position yourself within social structures. And so friendship takes on a certain kind of utility in those spaces, because allegiances take on a certain kind of utility, right? Like your who you are allied with really matters in a space where partisan politics is so hot.
Hmm. Yeah. So I think in some ways that kind of goes back to the point we made earlier about stakes, right? For Dante and his contemporaries, these are not just theoretical questions. They really have kind of practical consequences as well. So I'd like to kind of get into the poem and sort of how Dante is thinking about these concepts. Can you help us understand the term amista in the Vita Nova specifically? What does it mean in that context? And to what extent is this meaning kind of Dante describing it or discussing it in ways that the audience would have been like, yep, that's how we all think about it, versus Dante being like, hang on a second, guys, I've got a different idea here and I kind of want to shock you a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, okay. So in the Vita Nova, the Vita Nova is Dante's earliest completed work. I don't want to call it completed, but it's his earliest long work. He had circulated a number of poems up to that point, and then he gathers his poems and writes a sort of a prose narrative to accompany those poems. And in that text, let me back up. One of the things that's interesting about that text is that the poems pre-existed the prose narrative. And so the poems might be doing certain things that the prose narrative then reframes or reconstructs. And so the poems themselves have been circulating in an environment in which the language of friendship is ambivalent. And so poets would use the word amico, friend, when they write these what are called tensoni, their correspondence poems. So I would write a sonnet and send it to a friend and say, oh friend, you know, please explain this dream for me, or oh friend, here's a question that I have about love, or here's a question that I have about my lady, or whatever. And so as they were, you know, they would write these poems to one another, not only in serious terms, but, you know, also using the word friend to really mean rival, or to really, you know, to soften the blow of reproach. But, you know, friend, amico in this way was used to, as like a typically used as a way of extending one's network. And so, you know, I call you a friend, even if you are not actually someone that I would think of as a friend in real life. You know, it's like this distinction that we have between friend and Facebook friend, you know, like the friend in reality versus the friend in performance. And so they had a lot of these performative friendships. This was like a sort of essential part of their poetic tradition. They would write to a friend in these exchange poems, and then the friend, it was anticipated that the friend would respond. And so people would do this as a way of showing how central they are in the network of poets at the time. So Dante in the Vita Nova, in the poems of the Vita Nova, is participating in this tradition. You know, he's using the word friend in these ways that and let's say maybe not in the poems of the Vita Nova, but certainly in his early poetry, he uses this word friend in these same kinds of ways. This where it can mean true friend, but it can also mean this kind of performance of friendship. Then in the Vita Nova, when he reframes those poems, he selects a certain number of them, he puts them in a particular order, and he writes this prose narrative that accompanies it. And in that prose narrative, he really ups the stakes on a particular friendship of his, aligning himself very carefully with another poet named Guido Cavalcanti. And scholars have always assumed, and I guess there's no reason not to assume, that they didn't have a very strong biographical relationship, that there's not a kind of authenticity to their relationship aside from what Dante, you know, outside of what Dante says in the Vita Nova. But I'm less interested in, like, is that authentically true? And I'm more interested in how does he perform that? And in, like, how does he see that as positioning himself in a certain kind of way within his poetic society? And so when he writes about Guido Cavalcanti, he writes about him as a particular kind of friend with a deep intimacy with Dante, who understands, you know, very deeply the same kind of philosophy, who shares his point of view, who maybe disagrees with him on certain minor points, but who ultimately sees the same kind of, you know, who aligns with him in all of the ways that it matters, and he sets them up as this sort of society of two that that elevates them above the fray of the other poets who would just toss the word friend around just to get themselves ahead in this network. And so he sort of leans into this, you know, what I would think of as a kind of Ciceronian model, where he says, you know, because we are so bound together, me and Guido, we make each other more excellent. And in making each other more excellent, we rise above all of you others, all of you other fools. In fact, he uses the word fools, foolish, to describe all the other poets in the period. So it has this, like, strangely, it's using the word friend in this strangely antisocial way, where you set two apart to become a kind of clique. And then separate those two from everyone else. I don't think that was, like, I guess I can't say that was radically different from things that we see elsewhere. But it is really setting Dante up when he's very young in his career. It sets him, his friendship up with Guido in a very particular kind of way that was very different from the practice of friendship that was being cultivated by so many other poets in the same social network.
Hmm. All right. So given kind of what he's doing there, and as you said, that it is happening early on in his career, I'm curious to ask you about kind of what happens as he gets older, particularly mm-hmm. what happens once he's exiled in 1302. Mm-hmm. To what extent does this impact these thoughts he's having about friendship?
His exile in 1302 was the definitive moment of his life. And this is true of his literary life. This is true of his very livelihood. He had to, when he went into exile, he would have had to, you know, beg for, or maybe not beg, but rely on the kindness of others for shelter, for food, for protection. It introduces all of this precarity into his existence. And so his literary life changes, his political life changes. He's exiled as a result of political machinations and begins to see himself not as aligned with a political party, but as what he would later describe as a party of one, a party of himself. And obviously it has major social implications. So it shifts his entire social existence. He leaves his wife behind when he goes into exile. He leaves his children behind when he goes into exile. Some of them would eventually join him, but most of them he leaves behind. He leaves behind friends. And he's removed from these spaces that have been his, like the central spaces of his of his entire life up to that point. I mean, he traveled some on embassies, but you know, the vast majority of his time in his young life was spent in Florence, and now suddenly he cannot return to that city on penalty of death. So, obviously, this is a decisive moment for the poet, and in the earliest years of his exile, you know, as he is removed from his social spaces and his civic spaces, he has to rethink his entire framework for thinking about the social organization of his life. So in the earliest phase of his exile, he first attempts to align himself with some fellow exiles, hoping to get themselves quickly back into the city, hoping to, you know, work their way back in, overturn their convictions, essentially, and to be able to reintegrate himself. That plan falls apart rather quickly. And in those early years, he's kind of casting around, figuring out where he will go, what he can do. And at the time, one of his friends from his former life, another Tuscan poet, not a Florentine poet, but a Tuscan poet, named Cino da Pistoia, had gotten himself into a very central position within the network of poets and intellectuals in the university center, the sort of center of intellectual life in Italy, which was the city of Bologna. And so it's in these early years of his exile that he writes a treatise on language called the De Vulgari Eloquentia, on the excellence of the vernacular, on the eloquence of the vernacular, where he, you know, makes an argument for why poets should be writing in vernacular languages instead of writing in Latin. And there's this what seems a kind of unusual move if you're thinking about friendship and you're sort of looking at Dante's career. There's this strange shift where suddenly Guido Cavalcanti, who had been so central to his poetic upbringing, who was the central figure of his Vita Nova, aside from Beatrice, his beloved, Guido Cavalcanti, who had been his greatest ally, or at least he had positioned it as greatest ally, suddenly effectively disappears from the De Vulgari Eloquentia to be replaced by Cino da Pistoia, this poet who has this kind of extensive network. You know, Cino is engaged in lots of correspondences with fellow poets in the period. He seemed to be quite the networker, and it's in that treatise that Dante begins to ally himself very carefully with Cino, almost as if he's hoping that his allegiance with Chino, his loyalty to Chino, will position him to be able to assert himself into the network of poets operating in Bologna, in and around Bologna, as if he's hoping to, you know, leverage that relationship as this kind of network extender to put him into a new network that would provide him a certain kind of security. And what I find especially interesting about this, what I write about in this chapter, you know, apropos of these dilemmas of friendship, that, you know, theoretically speaking, again, thinking about Cicero and thinking about even about, also about the Christian tradition of friendship, theoretically speaking, the best forms of friendship are meant to be disinterested, right? We can't, if we are trying to make ourselves into the most morally excellent people we possibly can, and if we are using our friendships as a means to better ourselves and to better our friends, then our friendships can't also be grounded in this kind of exchange of favors. We can't seek a friendship out with someone because we're hoping that they'll do something for us. And so in the De Vulgari, Dante has to thread this needle very carefully between setting himself up as someone who is in need of the support of a friend, which he very much was, and setting himself up as someone who is, you know, in this kind of morally excellent Ciceronian style, disinterested friendship where they would rely on one another, but not because of need, only because each of them is so excellent that they could provide the other with the kinds of support, you know, and Chino would automatically provide Dante with the kind of support that Dante would need without Dante even having to ask. So that's the, you know, there's this very delicate dance that he's doing in these years where he's, you know, again, trying to walk very carefully between not showing himself as being self, or showing his friendships as being self-interested, while simultaneously maintaining that they are, you know, while maintaining that they are, you know, productive moral excellence and so on.
Yeah, this is something I found fascinating reading the book, because kind of my mental image of this time and place is very much about patronage networks, right? Mm. And this being so key to how kind of any of this functions socially, politically, economically. So this kind of moral ideal of friendship that doesn't seem to allow for friendship between people, you know, patrons and the people that they sponsor, and was like, wait, hang on, but then how did that work? How could you possibly have friends in that context? Is there anything further you'd like to say on that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A couple of things. One is that there's an important precursor for this, which is a man named Brunetto Latini, who is, you know, only studied by Italianists, by Italian medievalists, but who was really such a fascinating figure. And he was Dante's teacher. Dante would eventually damn him among the sodomites in the circle of violence. But he had, you know, he was also in exile. He also, you know, wrote important works while he was in exile. And much like Dante, he used friendship as one of the frameworks for help for making his way through his exile. And he has a friend that he describes in one of his texts that he calls his port. So he is a ship adrift at sea, and he finds while he's in his exile, and he finds a friend in a foreign space, and that friend becomes his port. And I think Dante really thought about friendship in that way as well. I think, you know, at first when he's exiled, he's looking for Chino da Pistoia to be his port, and that falls through. Chino, you know, either, I mean, it seems to have not worked. Dante abandoned the De Vulgari Eloquentia part of the way through the writing of it. What did eventually work was precisely, as you said, getting his foot in the door with a patron. The patron that he would eventually settle with is a man named Cangrande della Scala, who was a very young, very wealthy nobleman in Verona, based in Verona, who was well renowned for welcoming poets, artists, for having a very lively cultural center at his court. And Dante would eventually settle with Cangrande and spend a long period of his time in exile at Cangrande's court. There are all kinds of funny stories about Dante. You know, Dante was reputed to be a sort of snobbish, persnickety person. And so there are all kinds of very fun stories that sort of legends about the relationship between Dante and Cangrande, where Dante is sort of always turning his nose up at the antics of the folks at Cangrande's court. And Cangrande would, you know, tease Dante for being so persnickety. But, you know, we don't really know anything about their actual relationship, and we can't really imagine that they had much of an actual relationship in terms of like shared, like what we would think of as a friendship, you know, shared intimacies, confidences, things like that. It was likely nothing of the sort. But in the same way that we still use the language of friendship to describe patronage, you know, we would say someone is a friend of the museum, for example, if they give a donation. They also spoke about friendship, friendship was also part of the discourse of patronage of the period. But again, it was a kind of delicate dance because the client is a social inferior and the patron is a social superior. And so the client can't very well say, "You, my superior, are my friend," because friendship is a relationship of equality. And so how do you walk that line? How do you negotiate that dilemma? So Dante does this really peculiar thing in his relationship to Cangrande. He writes a letter to him. This is later in his life, where he dedicates the Paradiso to Cangrande. The letter is disputed. The authenticity of it is disputed, whether it was actually in Dante's hand or not. But the first four paragraphs of the letter, this very short piece of the letter at the beginning, are generally accepted to be Dante's, actually in Dante's voice, that it is authentically Dante that's writing. And in those four paragraphs, he lays out this really exquisite, I think, very well-wrought argument for why he, Dante, a social inferior, can in fact call himself friend of his patron, Cangrande, who is his superior. He has to sort of make clear that he, by calling him friend, he is not suggesting that he's somehow Cangrande's equal in all ways, but that they are equals in their discernment. That's the term that he uses. They're like intellectual discretion. And so he finds ways to argue for equality between them, or to perform a kind of equality between them, while still deferring to Cangrande as his social superior. They're four very short paragraphs, and I think they're really extraordinary. It's actually my favorite chapter of the book, the chapter on patronage.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, it is exactly as you said, kind of such a fine balance to try and strike. I do want to pick up, though, on someone else you've mentioned as being kind of another key figure for Dante, which is, of course, is Beatrice. So can you walk us through, Beatrice is described in the Commedia as amico. I believe I've pronounced that vaguely correctly. Can you take us through kind of how that description would have been received by Dante's contemporaries and his audience, given sort of all of these different nuances that we've discussed so far?
Of course. Beatrice is one of the hardest, for me, one of the hardest characters to figure out. And, you know, not only in terms of her friendship with Dante, or like how we want to characterize her relationship with Dante, but she's just sort of, she has always been for me a mysterious figure, and I think for Dante too. I think that, you know, for good reason, she's mysterious to me, because I think she was difficult also for Dante to make sense of, to reckon with. So the passage that you're referring to is in Inferno 2. It's in the very beginning of the Divine Comedy. Dante has set off on his journey following Virgil, and he finds himself gripped with anxiety And he says, you know, I can't make this journey. There's no possible way that I can do this. He says, I am not Aeneas, the great hero. I am not Paul, the visionary. And you know, who am I to be able to do this? And so Virgil gives him an explanation and says, well, you know, this is willed by the women of heaven. This is willed by Mary herself, who dispatched St. Lucy, to whom you are especially devoted, who then dispatched Beatrice to come to get me. And that's how I, Virgil, came to be here to guide you. And this is meant to be a very heartening speech for Dante. And of course it is. But in that speech, when Virgil is recounting this chain of grace, as we like to think of it, you know, this chain of women who bestow grace upon Dante, he explains that when Beatrice arrives in hell, to in limbo, to send Virgil on his way to collect Dante, she says, I need you to rescue my friend, l'amico mio, who is no friend of fortune. And in describing him as amico mio, my friend, I mean, this is unusual for a couple of reasons. First, that the language of amicizia, the language of friendship, amistà, retreats in the space of the comedy to be replaced by other kinds of social structures or social forms, especially brotherhood. Brotherhood and sisterhood become the kind of one of the better moral grounds for thinking about our relationships to the others that surround us. Friendship becomes, you know, the term is like redolent with tensions and anxieties and rivalries and all of this dissembling that we've seen in Dante's previous poetry and his previous works. And so I think in the comedy, he sort of strategically distances himself from that language. But then Beatrice calls him a friend. And in fact, she's the only character in the entire comedy to refer to the pilgrim with that term, to call the pilgrim amico, instead of calling him, you know, frate, which means brother, which is the preferred term of nearly all of the other souls that he will meet along his journey, with the exception of Virgil, who calls him filial, which means son. So Beatrice calls him amico mio, and amico mio had all of these resonances for Dante's contemporaries. It would be a term of that was used in a lot of erotic poetry. It was a term that came up in for example, troubadour poetry, where amico effectively means lover, much closer to lover, my lover, than it does, or my beloved, than it does to my friend. It's a term that in the letters of Abelard and Heloise, it's a term that Heloise uses with Abelard. She says, I would prefer that you call me amica which gets translated to mistress. It's used in the Song of Songs. It's the term that the bridegroom uses for the bride in the Song of Songs, amica mea. And so it has both Christian resonances. It has deeply erotic resonances. And yet Dante has been using it in these, you know, extremely ambivalent ways elsewhere in his works. And so the question becomes, like, how do we make sense of Beatrice's use of the term in Inferno 2? You know, is this an erotic relationship that's being recast as a spiritual one? Is this term, you know, still redolent with all of the tensions of his previous poetry, or is it somehow being erased of all of those tensions? If it's being erased, why does it not appear elsewhere? Why is it not fully accommodated? It's only applied to this particular relationship. Is it that Virgil, a classical authority, is using the term friend? In fact, Virgil uses the term friend rather liberally, I would say. Is it that Virgil is using the term friend in a way that isn't entirely accurate to the theological framework that we're supposed to be entering into in the comedy. I think it's an unresolved issue. You know, I give a resolution to it in the book. I present a sort of resolution to it in the book, but you know, frankly, it's one of the pieces that I find. I don't want to say it's one of the questions that I feel like I haven't fully answered for myself. I don't think I've still fully understood what Dante meant when he put those words in Beatrice's mouth. I think it's for me still the hardest and most fascinating puzzle that I'm still hoping to keep thinking through and keep trying to articulate.
Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts and articulation with us and kind of bringing us into the fascinating elements of it. And that nicely as well leads to kind of my penultimate question about whether there was anything in the research or the writing or the thinking about this book that particularly surprised you.
Yeah, I mean, it's Beatrice that I find most surprising. You know, I have to be honest. When I set out to work on this project as a graduate student, part of the reason that I wanted to work on friendship was because I wanted to avoid Beatrice. I've always found her just a difficult character to wrap my head around. And I thought, well, if I write about friendship, then at least I'll be writing about Dante's relationship to other men, and I don't have to think about how romantic or erotic love would be caught up in his universe. And yet, nevertheless, there she is saying, amico mio, throwing a wrench in the works, as it were. But that's not, I think the most surprising thing, I suppose, about the project was simply that it at the time that I wrote it, no other book existed on a full book length study of Dante's ideas on friendship had been written up to the point that I wrote my book. There in the interim between my dissertation and my book, there was another study that came out on Dante and friendship, but it's quite different from mine. Its approach is very different from mine. So I think the most surprising thing to me was that there was so much space for this research to be done. And there is still so much space for more to be said about these relationships that I think are, you know, so fundamental to not only to Dante's life. I mean, obviously they're crucial for Dante's life, but they're fundamental for the way that we think about the social organization of life in that period. They're fundamental to the way that we think about, you know, sort of leading forward to Renaissance social structures. They're fundamental for the way that we organize our own social lives. And so it was surprising to me that there was still so much space in the scholarly field. This is always the problem with Dante studies. There's, you know, 700 years of scholarship on this author who has been, you know, who has been canonized basically since the time of his death. So much has already been said, and yet, you know, I was able to identify this really fundamental thread of thinking that had yet to be fully explored.
Very interesting. And I always find that question often gets a kind of behind the scenes sort of answer, and that very much is in that vein. So thank you for sharing.
Sure.
As a final question, can I ask what you're working on now or next? Is it still exploring friendship, or what might you be working on now that this book is done?
So my research has always kind of taken shape in two very different directions. So on the one hand, I'm a literary historian, and I work on sort of historicizing Dante's period. So I think about Dante in his context. But I'm also, at the same time, an editor on a digital project that's called Dante Today, which is thinking about the resonance of Dante's works across the 20th and 21st centuries. You know, not just in European culture or Anglo-European culture, but around the world. And so since 2012, I've been a co-editor on this project with my co-author, Ariel Saber, who founded the website Dante Today. And so for the past 12 years, I've been helping Ariel and the rest of our research team, undergraduates from our institutions, a couple of DH specialists, digital humanities specialists, to build this archive of over 2,000 references to Dante and his works, in, you know, music, in literature, in visual arts, in architecture, but also in pop culture, in consumer goods, in memes and social media, sort of all over contemporary life. And it's a project that I find really energizing and fascinating, and I've been hoping to dedicate full time to this project for a long time. So now I'm working on, aside from, you know, just working on the archive itself, which is in need of a redesign. We're in the process of redesigning and relaunching the website with the help of a design studio called Studio Rainwater. It'll be relaunched in the next calendar year. In addition to just, you know, working on the site itself, I'm also developing a book project related to what I call Dante memes. So what I'm thinking about are the kind of units of culture that get pulled out of the universe of the poem and then take on a sort of viral life of their own in the 20th and 21st centuries, especially in digital culture. So for example, I'm looking at the ways that the circles of hell, that the idea of hell being organized into circles gets picked up and manipulated by culture makers of all kinds, bloggers, you know, on social media, you know, even like in our everyday vernacular speech, where we might say, you know, there's a circle of hell for people who, or, you know, standing in line at the TSA pre-check, or, you know, at the TSA at this airport is a circle of hell. So that's what I'm working on now.
Very intriguing. Thank you for sharing that with us. Best of luck, obviously, with the kind of immediate aspects of a new website, as well as the longer term pieces. And of course, listeners can look forward to that, but also read the book we've been discussing titled On Amista, Negotiating Friendship in Dante's Italy. Beth, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Miranda. This has been really fun.